So I overcommitted our hardworking photocopier, and we only have three copies at this point. So hopefully, Mr. Breen, with you and at least Mr. Coyne having copies, we can proceed?
Certainly fine for us, yes.
Everyone else okay with that? All right. Ms. Rotterham?
I'll try to pick up where I left off. So I was asking you questions, and it's still up on the screen, about the commission's final determination and stating that the commission does not expect utilities will consistently achieve growth in dividends greater than nominal GDP growth. And I had asked you, I had said, I assume you disagree with this finding. Oh, your mic isn't on.
Let's start with that. could you just restate your question for me?
Okay. So we had left
Excuse
off.
Me. I had... Sorry. Mr. Chair, the screens for the consumer advocate and the small business advocate are off.
We're going dark.
Perhaps.
Okay, I think we're good to try it again.
Third time's a charm. I'll ask the same question again. So I had read into the record paragraph 155 there that you can see on your screen or in the hard copy for you. And in that paragraph, I'll just paraphrase, it's the board made a finding that it does not expect utilities will consistently achieve growth and dividends greater than nominal GDP growth rate. And I had asked whether you disagree with that statement. Or that finding, rather.
I do disagree with it, but okay. I recognize the concern from that commission and others that have raised this issue, and that's why there and here I presented the multi-stage approach to our model, and that's the model upon which I base my recommendation. So it leans into that argument that some have the concern that analyst growth rates are upwardly biased. So therefore, for the first 5 years of our earnings growth forecast, we use analyst growth rates, and then from there, trends to GDP, which is the approach accepted by the board in this decision. I've used that same approach in our analysis here.
Okay. All right, I'm gonna look to the last bulleted statement there in your rebuttal. And that says the AUC has used a substantially higher beta coefficient than the 0.45 recommendation of Dr. Cleary. And you've referenced, don't mind just scrolling down just a tiny little bit, to the footnotes. Paragraph 132. Correct?
Yes.
Okay, so Mr. Norwood, you don't mind pulling up paragraph 132 of the decision, and that's on PDF page 34. So I'll just read the first little bit of that decision in that paragraph that you referenced in your rebuttal. It says the commission concludes the utility stocks are appreciably less risky and volatile than equities in the broader market and therefore considers a reasonable range of betas for regulated gas and electricity utilities to be between 0.45, representing Dr. Cleary's unadjusted long-term beta, and 0.75 in the range of the adjusted betas recommended by D. Madsen and D. Diascendis. Might have mispronounced that. Do you see that there?
I do.
Okay, so when I read your reference, it says that the commission used a substantially higher beta coefficient, but when I read the paragraph you've referenced, it looks to be the opposite of what that decision says. It says it falls within a reasonable range or appropriate range. Do you agree with that?
Well, I read it differently than you. I see it as being the low end of the range, and 7.5 as being the high end of the range. If we know nothing else and we were to average those, it would put you at a beta of 60. That's substantially higher than Dr. Cleary's recommendation.
Okay. So you're just saying the median of that is substantially higher, and that's why you've referred to it as being substantially higher than what the...
Yes, that's a substantial difference in beta and makes a significant difference in the impact of the model results.
Okay.
Sorry, Mr. Coyne, I understand where you're going with the average, but in terms of what the AUC says here in this paragraph, it considers a reasonable range of betas for regulated gas and electric utilities to be between 0.45 and 0.75. It didn't talk about a specific point. Am I wrong in that?
Not in that paragraph, and this is where you can take from that what you will. When you go to the... let me see if I can find their CAPM summary where they bring the pieces of the puzzle together. I'm not sure if they ever do it for us. Let's see. Yeah, and on table 3, you can see the recommendations of the parties for beta, which range from 0.79 on the, on the high end to Dr. Vladson's, who includes different proxy groups, and hers are as high as 1.54, down to the low end on the next page, which is Dr. Cleary. So they cite that range of 45 to 75. So I take away from that that it did not accept 4.5 as being the number it would use for beta in its calculation.
It accepted it was within a reasonable range, as I read the decision. And you know, if you disagree with that, that's fine.
Well, I think the language is what the language is in that paragraph.
Right.
A reasonable range between 45 and 75. Yes.
Yeah, with 0.45 being the bottom. That's the floor of the range.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, and on that, the beta issue, in that same decision, I'm looking at the paragraph up from the one that was referenced in your rebuttal, so paragraph 131. I can give you a second to just familiarize yourself with that.
Yes, I'm with you.
Okay, so in that paragraph, it summarizes the evidence that you had given in that proceeding for betas to be between the range of 0.83 to 0.86, correct?
Yes.
Then the commission also looks at other expert betas ranging between 1.01 and 1.21, correct?
Well, in the reference prior to that is 0.51 to 1.72. Yes.
Yes, okay. And then the conclusion the commission actually makes is that range, those ranges, are unreasonably high.
I think correct? You need to read that sentence. My interpretation is that in its entirety, the commission finds these are unreasonably high given its findings regarding the overall risk of Alberta utilities. So it's made a finding that it believes that Alberta's utilities are less risky than the proxy group companies. And I think that's part of their thinking around those, because it says so in the sentence, those betas as being too high for those utilities.
Okay.
And again, I'm just reading the sentence for what it states.
Yeah. Okay. And as I understand the evidence that was filed in this proceeding, one of the main issues or the disagreements was about using beta adjustments. Is that right?
There was a lot in that proceeding, but insofar as the CAPM model was concerned, that was one of the issues, yes.
And the commission in that decision had disagreed that betas were understated in the absence of a HMATA adjustment. That's just based on the paragraph we just read.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, if we scroll up a little bit further to paragraph 129, it's kind of on two pages there. I don't know if you can get both of it. Yeah, that's it. Oh, scroll down a little bit. There. I don't think I need to read this into the record, but I can give you a second to review it. The commission was also critical of the Bloom adjustment being warranted in determining betas for regulated utilities. Is that correct?
Would you reread it? You're at the top of 129?
It's the paragraph 129, yep.
Yes, okay. You're just asking me to accept what the first sentence says?
Yep.
That paragraph?
Yeah.
I agree. It says that.
And the commission in that paragraph gave the reason for not using the Bloom adjustment was that utilities face less risk than average. Next section down.
Well, there are several things that they're saying in that paragraph. One is they're uncertain. They laid this out as an issue for this proceeding as to whether or not beta should be adjusted, and if so, by what methodology. So they're saying that after all this evidence, we're still unsure. That's what they're saying in the first paragraph, in the first sentence. The second sentence, as to there are ample reasons to question on what basis the systematic risks faced by regulated utilities might ever be expected to approach, much less exceed, those for the market as a whole, which is a central premise of the Bloom adjustment.
Yes.
I don't understand, because the Bloom adjustment never gets you to a beta that would equal or exceed the market as a whole. So it seems to me as though the commission has that impression, but that's not what the Bloom adjustment does.
Okay, so you're saying you disagree with that, those findings.
I'm confused by that sentence, because that's not what the Bloom adjustment does. But I sense the commission expressing its confusion around that issue, and what the intent of the Bloom adjustment is what I read in the second sentence. But then they go on to acknowledge, in the last sentence, they acknowledge that it's widely used by finance professionals and it's useful in certain circumstances. So.
Okay, and in that decision, the commission didn't use the Bloom adjustment beta coefficients, did they?
You recall that in the sentence that we discussed, 0.45 to 0.75, they accepted a range, and that range included adjusted betas at the upper end of that limit and unadjusted betas, or Dr. Cleary, subjectively adjusted betas at the lower end. 45, Dr. Cleary's beta, is not something you can find in statistical analysis. It's his judgment as to what beta should be for Canadian utilities.
I'll let the decision speak for itself. I'm not going to go back and forth as to what the decision says. I understand in this proceeding you're suggesting that the betas be adjusted using the Bloom adjustments, correct?
Yes. In our evidence, we use, in the CAPM model, we use the Bloom adjustment methodology. The betas have changed since we presented this analysis. The beta for the proxy group I use is 0.64%, which is well within the range that was cited by the commission on this decision.
What you're looking at is you're basing on what's in the report, correct, that you filed?
My report in this evidence.
Yes, yeah.
Our beta for this T&D proxy group is 0.64.
Okay.
That's well within the range cited as reasonable by the Alberta Commission in their decision. 0.45, which Dr. Cleary continues to use, would continue to be at the low end of the reasonable range according to this commission.
Okay. Now, in using the Bloom adjustment, Concentric's reference the decision of the BCUC accepting that methodology, correct?
Could you restate your question?
We can pull up your report. I'm going to move off the decision here. We can pull up Appendix N1, or sorry, Exhibit N1, Appendix A, PDF page 77.
Is that the rebuttal testimony?
Nope, that's your report.
Okay. And which page?
It's PDF page 77. Okay, sorry.
48 at the top.
Forty-three of the report.
I'm with you.
Okay. Now, other than this one decision you've referenced, can you confirm for me, in your knowledge, that there's no other Canadian jurisdictions that have endorsed this Bloom adjustment?
Some commissions are not explicit in their decisions. They accept evidence from different witnesses, and they render their decision without necessarily indicating they accept one input or one model in that process. This is the one decision I'm aware of where the commission, at least in my recent memory, has explicitly accepted it. Having put this out as an issue, it was concerned, as the Alberta Commission was, that it have additional evidence around this issue to consider it. And it hired its own independent analyst to look at this issue along with the evidence that we presented on behalf of Fortis.
Okay. Maybe it will be helpful to pull up that BCUC decision from 2023 that you've referenced in your evidence there. Mr. Norwood, I sent you the link. Might be helpful to just pull up the link. That's it. If you don't mind going, well, I guess I can just confirm. This is the decision you're referencing in your evidence, correct? Decision from September 5th, 2023.
Yes.
Okay. If you don't mind going to PDF page 85.
Do you hold on there for a second?
Oh, yep.
Sorry, just in terms of the Alberta decision first, I appreciate their regulatory decisions and probably don't need to be marked as exhibits, but the Alberta one in particular is a little bit tricky to find if you're looking for it, so it might make sense to mark that as an exhibit.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay.
So that would be exhibit N17. And this really just to keep track of it. It's not evidence per se. We do the same thing with the British Columbia decision here that you have pulled up. We'll mark that exhibit N18.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right. So, all right, if you don't mind scrolling down a little bit. So this is page 76 of the decision, PDF page 85, and I'm looking specifically starting where it says Mr. Coyne. Do you see that there?
Yes, I see that.
Okay, it says, Mr. Coyne states that he is not aware of any Canadian jurisdictions that have specifically endorsed the use of the Bloom Adjustment betas. And then you, just moments ago, you had said that in your most recent recollection, this was the only decision you could think of where it was endorsed. Has anything changed specifically?
I'm trying to remember how the Ontario Board dealt with this issue. And my recollection is, well, unlike the 2009 Ontario decision that was more detailed in terms of its approach and its outcome, and its most recent decision, it placed considerable weight on the evidence of London Economics, which was the board staff hired expert. And my recollection is that London Economics used adjusted betas in their analysis. The board placed weight on the London Economics analysis as their expert, but I don't recall whether or not they specifically endorsed the use of the adjusted beta. So I think my memory would still be the same, that this is the most explicit endorsement. I would add that in the U.S., it's interesting to me, as one who testifies extensively in both the U.S. and in Canada, that in no U.S. jurisdiction is the Bloom adjustment to betas considered an issue, as it is here. It's not a controversial input typically to the CAPM model. On this page, if you scroll up, if we could do that.
I fear we're getting off track of the questioning, and I just want to make sure. Perhaps this is required for you to answer the question fully, but I think your answer was you were not aware of any other Canadian jurisdictions that have explicitly endorsed this methodology.
No, but the last sentence in the first paragraph I find telling from the Commission, and this is an important issue because some will contend that there's somehow bias in adjusting the beta in this way, and I believe that the Commission's finding is accurate, that using the average of values published by Valueline and Bloomberg is reasonable. And that's an approach that we use typically to make sure that we're getting the best information that's out there that investors would use in their interpretation of what beta is for these companies. It's not a judgment that we're applying based on looking at historical data.
Okay. In this proceeding, perhaps you have a memory or I can bring you to the reference in the decision, there was no expert evidence contrary to your view of using that Bloom adjustment, correct?
No, the other expert was hired by the board, Dr. Lesser, and he concurred with our view.
And there was no objections to the use of the adjustment, correct?
Not that I recall.
All right. Do you know whether the Nova Scotia board has ever used the Bloom adjustment previously?
I don't know. in Nova Scotia, my recollection is that there have been a number of settlements over the years, so I don't recall the same degree of scrutiny around the issue as has been received in some of these other jurisdictions that do more extensive generic cost of capital proceedings where these issues come up and they become more fully litigated than I think has probably been the case in Nova Scotia.
Okay. And there's no agreement in this case currently?
Well, Dr. Cleary and I certainly are not on the same page.
Okay. I'm going to shift gears a little bit, and I'm going to follow up on some questions that my friend Mr. Murphy had for you about the risk profile. But we don't need the decision here anymore. Thanks. Now, I understand that in assessing risk, it's a combination of both business risk and financial risk of a utility, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And you've based putting a risk premium adjustment of 75 to 100 basis points on your finding that NSPML, or you're suggesting that NSPML has different traits than the average T&D utility, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so I kind of want to understand what traits would influence business risk and financial risk. So first, just confirming the stability and predictability of regulation would impact that, right?
Yes.
And there's less risk with a stable regime, correct?
Stable and predictable, yes.
Yes. Another consideration you'd look at is whether rates are on cost of service or if they're performance-based, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and there's less risk when it's cost of service, correct?
Depends. As a general premise, debt investors in particular like cost of service, and in some cases equity investors do too. If they believe that it's going to allow the utility an opportunity to earn its return, and by virtue of being able to come in as often as it needs to file rates with changing costs. My view is that a cost of service regime, absent knowing anything else, generally is lower risk than a multi-year rate plan.
Okay. You'd also tend to look at cost recovery mechanisms and whether there's riders or timely recovery costs, which I think is what you just kind of were getting at there, correct?
Yes, riders influence the ability for timely recovery of costs. Yes, those are important.
Okay. And when there's timely recovery, there's less risk?
Yes.
Okay. And you'd also look to the frequency of rate adjustments, correct?
Yes.
More frequent, there's less risk. All else being equal.
Well, all else being equal, yes.
Okay. Having a monopoly status, you'd also look to as well, whether there's competition?
Virtually all regulated utilities, for the most part, are monopolies, so it's not a meaningful difference across companies.
Okay, would it lower risk to have exclusive service?
Again, virtually all these utilities are monopolies. In some cases, there's retail competition, but the utility has a monopoly on its transmission distribution business for all the companies that I've laid out here. So there's no meaningful difference in that regard.
Okay. Now, you'd also look to whether there's a decoupling mechanism, meaning if revenues decoupled from sales or volume, correct?
If it has a sales function, yes. So if it's a T&D company, I would look at that, yes.
Okay.
Not for a transmission company.
And if it is decoupled, the risk would generally be lower.
For a T&D company, yes.
Yes.
Again, just to finish the thought, most transmission companies are effectively decoupled, so it's not a meaningful difference there.
And because of that, transmission utilities are generally lower risk?
No.
No?
No. Transmission companies are a special class of utility asset. You know, if you look at how they're regulated by FERC, for example, they have substantially higher ROEs and equity ratios. Because of the nature of developing and constructing transmission assets is deemed to be, takes a longer period of time, more risk in execution associated with building and developing these assets than there are incremental T&D assets. And then if we look at a subsea cable asset, as is the case here, that's another special class of asset. So I would not agree with the premise that a transmission company alone is less risky than a diversified T&D company, if that's your question.
Fair. The state of that transmission company or the stage that it's at, whether it's in developing versus operating, would impact the risk, though, right?
Yes, generally speaking, okay. Yes. Development is a riskier stage for transmission life.
All right. And in looking at those traits that would impact financial risk, so moving back here, you'd also look at capital structure, meaning the higher the leverage, the increased the financial risk, right?
That's right.
Okay. And you'd also look at credit ratings?
Yes.
The better the credit rating, the lower the risk?
Lower the financial risk.
Yes. We're looking at both financial and business risk.
Right.
It helps. Assessing risk.
It helps me if I understand the context of your question.
All right. And then you'd also look to whether there's parent company support, correct, for assessing financial risk?
Generally not, because you'll notice in our evidence that we have a section on the standalone principle. And in most regulatory jurisdictions, the regulator looks at the regulated entity based on its own creditworthiness, its own operational risks, and things of that matter. So it is not it's not typical to look upstream to the parent company as a basis of judging risk. However, if you're a credit rating agency,
yes,
you may look upstream to see if there's credit support for establishing that credit rating.
So credit rating agencies would?
They do.
Okay. So you'd also look in assessing financial or, I guess, business risk, where the utility is located and the market conditions in that where that utility is located, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And you'd also look to whether population growth was there, and that may also reduce risk.
I typically look at economic growth more broadly than just population growth. I'd look at income growth. I'd look at housing starts, gross domestic product or gross provincial product, things of that nature. Population growth might be one element of that.
Okay. And I know you've mentioned today that T&D utilities generally have reduced risk. Part of the reason is that they have minimal exposure to commodity price risk, correct?
I don't think I used that language, but I said because they don't have generation assets.
No, yes, I'm putting that to you now.
Oh, could you restate your question?
They have reduced risk partially because they have minimal exposure to commodity price risks. Fluctuations, volatility.
Commodity price risk is part of it, but I consider the greater risk the technologies associated with generation that tend to change and cycle. And commodity price risk is one portion of it. As we see with Nova Scotia Power, for example, you can have periods where you have, by virtue of public policy and changing technologies, you have the need to completely transition a generation mix. So that's that creates a risk for that element of the industry that's unique to generation, and for that reason, GT&D companies are generally considered to be riskier than just T&D companies.
Okay. Now, in your analysis of NSPML's risk, you appear to raise three main additional risk factors that impact NSPML. Compared to the proxy groups you've used, correct?
I didn't hear the middle of your question. I peer reviewed.
Sorry, three main additional risk factors that you've attributed to NSPML that impacts its risk profile.
The operational risk factors, are you asking about those?
Yes, so it would be you've raised that it's a subsea cable transmission utility, that it manages complex contracts, and that it's highly leveraged.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I think my friend covered a lot of my questions here, so I'm just trying to place myself. One of the things I did want to follow up on, Mr. Dimmel has given evidence as to what it looks like managing some of those contracts. And the day-to-day and the hourly management of the those contracts, I guess, or the flow of the energy and stuff. Was anything that Mr. Dimmel said today new that you learned about how it manages the contracts?
I was not aware of the division of labor between NSPML and Nova Scotia Power in terms of how those contracts get managed.
Did anything that you learned today change your analysis in terms of the risk profile for NSPML in relation to its management of, as you've stated, highly complex contracts?
The way I saw it then and still see it is that NSPML is subject to financial risks that other utilities in my T&D sample are not subject to, and other transmission companies are not subject to. And, for example, the holdback mechanism is very unique to NSPML. I'm not aware of any transmission company that has that type of financial exposure for the throughput of energy across the cable. That's unique risk, and my understanding of that has not changed.
Okay. A few different things. I had understood your evidence to exclude any analysis in terms of the holdback mechanism. Am I correct on that?
I did not add any premium to this based on the holdback mechanism. What I've observed is that it's unlike any other transmission company.
Okay, and I had thought that in your evidence you had stated that the management of these highly complex contracts were in relation to its business risk assessment.
That was one of the factors I mentioned, yes.
Okay, and so when I was just asking whether anything had changed, you had said the way that you see it is that it's subject to financial risks that other utilities are not subject to, and then you kind of were going on about the holdback. So I was specifically asking about the business risk. So based on what you've learned today, would that change your assessment of NSPML's business risk?
No.
Okay. So moving on to financial risk, which appears to be what I understand your evidence to be the main contributing factor as to why there should be a risk premium adjustment. Is that right?
No.
Okay.
I look at both operational and financial risk, or business and financial risk, as a basis for that determination.
Okay. So I guess your evidence is saying that since NSPML is highly leveraged, meaning it's 30-70, that increases its financial risk, correct?
Yes.
Had you taken into consideration the fact that a lot of the debt is backstopped by the government?
Absolutely.
Okay. And you're saying that that does not impact the financial risk of the utility?
Well, as discussed earlier, I believe, with Mr. Murphy, it impacts the financial risk for the lender, which is backstopped by the Government of Canada. They have a return that's guaranteed. This is unusual by the assets, current and future, for NSPML to ensure that they get paid. It doesn't provide a guarantee for an equity investor. So I distinguish between those two. It creates greater risk for an equity investor because of the leverage involved. With only a 30% equity ratio in its balance sheet, it's more leveraged than almost any other transmission company in North America.
Okay. And I think I understand that to be one of the areas you disagree with Dr. Cleary as well, in saying that the federal loan guarantees impact the risk assessment here, and I had understood your evidence to be that the equity investor would be more at risk for disallowances. Am I correct?
Not more at risk for disallowances, but if there is a disallowance, if you only have a 30% or 22% equity ratio on your balance sheet, it has a proportionately greater impact on that company than it would for one that has a 50% equity ratio, which would be the average for most for these utilities in the U.S., for example.
Okay, and your understanding of when a disallowance would be granted is when there would be a finding of imprudence, correct?
That's one of the ways a disallowance can occur. A disallowance could occur for other reasons as well.
What other reasons?
A holdback could be another one.
Okay, but does the holdback get reimbursed at another time, or do they receive that back?
I would defer to my panelists to my right and further right in terms of how that would work. But if the energy ultimately is there, my understanding is that if the energy is ultimately provided, then there could be a reimbursement, but these folks could describe it better than
I think. Generally speaking, the form or the mechanism of the holdback and how it's put together and described in terms of the puts and takes would define whether or not the monies could be recovered. And so we know there's some that can't, and we're hopeful that there's some that can based on their application when we do put it forward to the board to end the current holdback. If I don't know if that clarifies the situation. It depends on the actual mechanism of the specific holdback and the timing of that mechanism, which is it has evolved from, I guess, 2021 to today.
So I guess the answer is it depends. But I would say it's unusual. I'm not aware of any other transmission company that has such a provision.
Okay, but where, as I understand, NSPML's evidence is that they're preparing to file this to get the holdback removed, and assuming it is, that's no longer going to be a risk concern to have that holdback as you've described it, as a disallowance.
That's right, and I did not add any premium to my ROE recommendation as a result of the holdback mechanism.
Yes.
I did for the equity ratio.
In assessing the financial risk, would you generally look at how a utility is paid or how their debt obligations are paid?
What was the beginning of your question?
In assessing financial risk of a utility.
Maybe you could just complete the entire question.
Okay. When assessing financial risk of the utility, would you generally look at how the utility is paid or how its debt obligations are paid in the run of a year?
Generally speaking, yes.
Okay. So for NSPML, would you say that the way that their debt obligations are paid would generally reduce its financial risks profile?
No. It increases the profile for the equity investor. Because, and the reason for that is that the government of Canada has first claim on a substantial portion of NSPML's revenues to meet those debt obligations. So that, you know, I think of that as a first mortgage bond obligation, but this is even stronger than that. Most utilities do not issue first mortgage bonds because they do not want that degree of financial inflexibility that comes with them. So that's a substantial degree of subordination that NSPML's equity investor is subject to that other equity investors are not subject to. In any other, certainly not in these T&D companies used in my proxy group or these subsea comparators.
Okay.
It's good for the debt investor because they have a guarantee, that's a rock-solid guarantee that they have to get repaid, but it presents a different picture for an equity investor.
On that issue, in the United States, there's more securitization than there is in Canada. How would the equity investor in the United States look at, it's not a first mortgage, but it's obviously securitized debt is held at a higher rank than other debt, isn't it? Wouldn't there be, I'm just, you know, when you said that the equity investor or that there are no, you know, first mortgages for sort of type arrangements in the United States, but there are several instances where there are significant securitized debt that presumably lies sort of at the top of the ladder.
Yes, good question, Vice Chair. Securitization is somewhat selectively used in the U.S. Generally, we see securitization used when, in recent examples, it's been not unlike in Nova Scotia to address the issues, the cost associated with early retirement of coal-fired plants. And in some cases, those obligations have been securitized. In other cases, we have seen, there have been you may remember, Winter Storm Uri that created significant disruption in gas markets. And many gas utilities ran up significant balance sheet payables associated with their gas purchases. And in order to address the impact on consumers, and not unlike Nova Scotia, those debt obligations have been, in some cases, securitized. And to get to, I think, your specific question, they benefit customers because the cost of financing is at a lower cost if it's securitized, typically, than a utility cost of capital. I guess you could say it benefits an equity investor because it takes care of a problem to the extent that that problem was going to exist on its balance sheet, not have a resolution in those cases. Otherwise, I think an equity investor is not directly impacted by that securitization. If you're securitizing assets in advance of their retirement age, which is the case with coal-fired plants, some equity investors would look at that as, A, taking care of the problem, but also income is being reduced because we're going to pull those assets out of rate base and go ahead and securitize them.
So you don't consider the FLG1, FLG2 somewhat like securitized debt?
I think
it doesn't take it off the balance sheet, sorry.
I consider it like it in the sense that it provides a guarantee that, and I see the primary beneficiary as being customers because it provides a lower source of financing for those assets than could be achieved through a standard WACC-associated utility approach. I don't recall what the cost of debt is on FLG1, but it's 3.5%. So, and the WACC for Nova Scotia Power is in the
approximately over 6, I would say.
Over 6%, so roughly half. So that's a significant benefit to customers. So that's really what I see the benefit of FLG1 and 2. As well as the securitization programs.
But the equity investor wouldn't see that as less risky as well?
In the case of Nova Scotia, NSPML, you have a 30% balance sheet, and most equity investors would get pretty nervous about that. In the case of these other utilities, they're maintaining 50% equity balance sheets, so I don't know that they would see the same degree of impact from a leverage standpoint that would be offsetting. So I don't know that I typically, the securitization programs that have been passed have typically been public policy initiatives, not so much by the utility as it has been from either regulators or public policy makers that are more concerned with the impact on customers than it is an equity investor saying, hey, this is really good for us.
Well, some of the examples that the utilities are pulled in kicking and screaming, but eventually right. They agree it, presumably for a reason.
Right. Ultimately, any utility knows that at the end of the day, they're in business with a public interest standard, and they need to abide by the overall regulatory compact that determines what's in the public interest guides the overall regulatory compact that under which they are regulated. So they understand that.
And in fairness, it allows them to freeze up their capital to invest in other more profitable ventures.
It may, yes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Just crossed off a bunch of my own questions there. In your rebuttal evidence, you've disagreed a number of times with Dr. Cleary's analysis of NSPI to base the proposed ROE for NSPML, correct? I guess what there's different references to, they're assessing the risk profile of NSPI versus NSPML, and that's the basis of a lot of the analysis in terms of the ROE that's recommended by Dr. Cleary. Is it's based and tied to NSPI's ROE.
Yeah, I thought of it differently pending the testimony, and that is what I saw with Dr. Cleary is no comparison to any utility group from a risk perspective, T&D or otherwise. His evidence, as I read it, you know, could have been submitted in the NSPI hearing. I wasn't sure if his evidence was associated with NSPI or NSPML, because there was no distinction between proxy group selection or risk analysis that would have informed the analysis for us to judge it in that regard. I didn't disagree with him on that basis. I was puzzled trying to understand to which audience he was which company he was addressing his analysis to.
So you don't take a position on whether NSPML's ROE should in fact be tied to NSPI's ROE?
I've not been asked to take a position in that regard.
So since we're here, I was actually going to ask you whether your view on that. So I'm going to ask you to take a position on it, if I may, because clearly Dr. Cleary feels they should be. I think the board has kind of pushed to have an independent assessment of NSPML's rate of return on equity, and that brings you here today. But yeah, in terms of that point, I know you mentioned earlier that the New England transmission companies, for example, all share the same rate of return. Do you have a view, or what is your view on whether NSPML's rate of return on equity should be tied to Nova Scotia Power's?
You put me squarely on the spot, haven't you? I see it through a couple of different perspectives. I certainly see regulatory efficiency there. You know, in the grand scheme of things, I see the overall the effort associated with this proceeding for NSPML as being significant. If I look at the size of the asset base versus other utilities and or NSPI. So to me, it suggests that a regulatory efficiency could be achieved in that regard. And then if I could take your question, maybe divide it into two pieces. You know, one is, should it be tied to it? And then the other is, should it be the same? So in BC, for example, the BC Commission sets a generic cost of capital, and then it determines a risk differential in ROE or equity ratio for the other utilities that it regulates. And I think that's a pretty good model, because it hashes out all the issues that we've talked about here today around what a capital market's doing, what's a reasonable proxy group. And there the BC Commission decides that for the longest time, Fortis BC Energy, the gas utility, is going to be the benchmark. And we'll go through all this, set the rate of return for the benchmark, and then we'll decide if you're more or less risky than the benchmark, and then decide what the increment should be. Probably the most interesting place that I've testified in Canada has been in the Yukon, where the Yukon Commission doesn't really sit as an active commission, as you may know, but they actually bring in staff from Alberta to staff their proceedings when they need to for the Yukon utilities. But yet they base their decisions on the BC decision and then determine what the appropriate incremental risk adjustment could be. So I could definitely see an advantage in tying it to NSPower, because I think a lot of the analysis would be common. Then I think you'd be left with a determination as to whether or not a risk differential is appropriate between the two. And, you know, based on our analysis, we have suggested a risk adjustment between 75 and 100 basis points is appropriate. And so it'd be up to the board to make determination as to whether or not such a risk adjustment was appropriate given the unique nature of these assets. But circling back to where I started, I can certainly see some administrative efficiency in doing it. And I think it could be done in a way that wouldn't compromise the justness and reasonableness of the result.
And in terms of the risk adjuster, I think if I followed everything, I know the answer to this, but I'll ask it just to be clear. In terms of a risk adjuster for NSPML compared to NS Power, I take it that would be an incremental increase from your perspective?
It would today. You know, I think the operational risks, as Mr. DeMille could speak to better than I can, will stay. I don't think those go away. If the board were to decide that not just on incremental capital, but on all capital, that we'll place that a 40% equity ratio along with NS Power, then I think you would be brought more into the ballpark of a return that would be more comparable. But the leverage differential between 30% and 40% would still exist, or 22% in actuality. Then I think you'd just be left with those operating risks and determination as to whether or not they warranted still some upward differential. And you'd close that gap, I guess, without having studied it further,
okay. In my judgment. No, and I appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you. Sorry again, Ms. Rutter.
No, that covers all of my questions. You did? Sorry,
Mr. Chair, we were just discussing whether we needed to do confidential questions, but I think we can forego those.
Okay, so that's it for your questions then?
That is it.
Thank okay.
You. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm assuming Nova Scotia Power doesn't have any questions. Port Hawkesbury Paper?
No questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Mahody? It's up to you, but 4:45, so probably makes sense to break at this point and come back at 9 in the morning.
I'm sure the answer should be fine. It'd be the questions that would be the problem, I'm certain. So, yes, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate that.
Okay. All right. So we'll adjourn for the day. Thank you. Thank you all very much to the panel. The usual caution. You remain under oath, so you're not able to discuss your testimony in this matter with anyone else other than amongst yourselves. And we'll reconvene at 9 in the morning. Thank you. And we're just going to unpack, so you feel free to go.